Going through a divorce is daunting and can make you feel financially vulnerable. Ampla Finance can help. Unlike other loans, there's no need for any ongoing monthly repayments. You're only charged loan interest on the amount of money used to pay your solicitor's fees as your case progresses, and the easy-to-use online tool keeps you in full control throughout the process. Your loan is normally repaid in full when you reach settlement, so between now and then, you have peace of mind that the cost of your divorce won't impact your day-to-day needs. Ampla Finance puts you at the heart of everything they do and can help you to make the fresh start you're looking for. To find out more, click the link in the podcast description or visit www.amplafinance.com.
Today we're going to be talking everything sustainable investing. So really enjoyed understanding a bit more about the history of sustainable investing and talking to Gavin Francis, who is an expert and so incredibly passionate about this subject. So if you want to know how you can invest more sustainably, more impactfully, then do listen on and please stick with us for the whole episode because it is well worth it. So let's jump right in. Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Smart Divorce Podcast. And today I'm joined by Gavin Francis from Worthstone, who is going to talk to us all about investing sustainably. So we had a bit of a conversation before we cracked off this podcast about what I should call the blanket term of various types of investing in a greener way. And I'm reliably informed by Gavin that the current term for it is sustainable investing. So before we get into the conversation, welcome, Gavin. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Would you like to tell everybody a little bit more about you, your background, and what makes you such an expert in this field?
Thank you, Tamsin. Well, firstly, thank you for inviting me to come on this podcast. I really appreciate that. And the opportunity to talk a bit more about sustainable investing, because that's something I love talking about and it's something I know a little bit about. So I don't like to call myself an expert. It's something I've been doing for a long time and it's all I do. But I've got so much more to learn and it's such a progressive area and it's moving so quickly. And there's so many intelligent and committed, purposeful people in the air that you're always learning, you know, and you're picking stuff up all the time, which is brilliant. I went to a conference earlier and we might touch on that. And there were some amazing people speaking and you just feel like you can't learn enough. You know, there's always stuff to pick up. So, yeah, but my background is actually in financial services. So I've worked in financial services for over 30 years now. Wow. And more latterly, in the last 15 years, it's been purely focused on sustainable investing. And I work with businesses like yours. So we're a business that we look at all of the sustainable funds that are available in the market, available to UK retail investors. And then we have a methodology to try and work out which of those funds are doing the things they say they're doing on the label and which are the ones that are the most sustainable, most impactful. And then we scope the market, work out what's in the market, then we rank the market, and then we rate those funds based on where we think they are, you know, how sustainable we think they are. So that service isn't available to the general public. It's not a B2C business. It's not available to clients direct. It's available to businesses like yours who then use that analysis to decide or try and work out what funds match their clients' objectives in this area. So that's what we do.
Fantastic. It's a tricky old area, isn't it?
It is. I think, like I say, because it's so progressive and up until the last couple of years, it was something that was seen as a little bit of a niche as well. So it was kind of tucked away in the corner. I think advisors were slightly frightened of it or wary of it. And so they won't necessarily mention it to clients unless unless a client comes to them and says, I really want to do this. It wasn't something they sort of brought up of their own volition, because in some ways they were maybe worried that they wouldn't have a solution or wouldn't know how to find the right solution. And that's why we set up Worthstone, was to try and make that easier for advisors so that they would talk more readily to clients. Because our ambition really is to just see more investors. I mean, we think that, you know, this will be investment. It won't be differentiated between traditional investment and sustainable investment. In the next decade, I think we will see that all investment will have to be sustainable investment. Because if you think about the next generation coming through, you think about our children and grandchildren. I haven't got any yet, but I'm hoping to have some at some point. But, you know, those next generations coming through, that's what they care about. You know, I have my daughter's the eco rep. I can't remember the exact terminology they use at school, but she presented it to her class, and her class have elected her as the sustainable person, whatever that is, terminology they use. But they're really passionate about this stuff. You know, they're the ones that are keeping us on our toes, and rightly so, because it's the legacy that we leave that they're going to have to pick up and run with. And at the moment, that's not looking a completely rosy picture. So we need to take our responsibility to do something about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I can certainly see. I mean, more businesses have to think about their sustainable impact on the planet and on climate change, etc. So these are all things that are in our business heads anyway. So probably it might not be a move necessarily to sustainable investing, but more of a move to businesses becoming sustainable, whatever they are. So like you say, I can see that it will be kind of commonplace. And it's becoming much more commonplace than the 20 something years ago that I started working in financial services. Yeah. I think it'd be a good idea to start off with the different names we have for this type of investing and try and explain to people what the differences are, because I think some of the complication, as always in financial services, is that we don't necessarily understand or have a description for or a meaning to the different types of investing. So I guess for me, the kind of first sort of experience in this type of investing will be in ethical investing, would be like pure ethical investing. I was brought up as a Quaker, so my background would be that any investment into arms, into tobacco, into pornography, into alcohol, into gambling, those would be no-go investments within the religion that I come from. And I guess that's where the kind of ethical investing part started. Would that be right in saying that?
I think you're absolutely right. We've actually got a video, and I'll share that with you, Tamsin, which goes through the history. It's just a 3-minute video because we've tried to keep it short, but it goes through the history. And, you know, the Quaker movement were right at the genesis of this movement originally. So, and it was all about exclusion. So it was like, you know, and it started from, you know, back in their roots. It was, you know, the catalyst for that was slavery. So they didn't want to invest in businesses that had any exposure to anything. So it was to do with social, actually, rather than environmental. And that's another thing we can talk about. You know, there's a mix here of social and environmental. And actually, the two are so intertwined, because if you look in the developing world, you know, if we, with climate change, you know, the people that are going to be worst affected by that are the poorest in our communities. So the two things are so interlinked. But sorry, coming back to your point, yes, you're absolutely right. Exclusionary, or what you exclude from, you know, your investment proposition, was where it kind of originated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember back in, you know, not that long ago, people saying, you know, I don't want to invest in, I think at the time it was, it would have been HSBC and Nestle. There were people who very particularly wanted to exclude specific, not even specific kind of areas, but actually specific businesses that they that they didn't want to invest in. And those were difficult to, it was difficult to find that without going down the fully discretionary route, you know. So that for me, that kind of would be the starting point. And I guess that then became the kind of ESG funds. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, you can map world history, basically. So what's happening in the world really impacts this area. So, for example, like you said, when the Quakers started doing this stuff, it was back in actually around the 1700s. It might have even been before the Quakers. I can't remember. It was around the 1700s, and it was related to slavery and things like that. And then as you go through history and things become apparent to us, you know, we realize actually the stuff we're doing is wrong. And it's changed the way in which this sustainable investing approach has happened. So, you know, more latterly, you had in the 70s, you had some movements in the US where people were saying to companies, like, you can't behave like this towards your workers. You know, so that's where that sort of ESG started. I think the E, S and G, so it's environmental, social and governance. So the 70s was where that governance type of stuff came in, where they were saying to, you know, it was the labor rights and the way people treated their employees in America, in Chicago, in the car manufacturing businesses and industrial businesses in Chicago. So that was the G. The social is obviously the, you know, the areas like, you know, how people are treated, people. And obviously the E is environmental. So it's like the planet, you know, how are we damaging the planet? And so that was coming about with the, I don't know if you remember, there was this big oil spill. And again, that happened, I think that was sort of the 70s or 80s, even coming into the 90s, I can't remember, but there was a big oil spill near Mexico.
Was that Exxon Valdez?
Yeah, and then there was a big movement, again, from the US, a big movement saying we can't have this anymore. And it got all the institutional money people together and said, we've got to put pressure on these companies to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen anymore. And that started a big movement there. So this was all swelling up. And then you know, it became a global issue. And then you had things like the ESG became a term, actually, through a report that was issued by the United Nations. That was in the 90s. And so then we had a kind of label for it, a specific label for it. And then you come into the 2000s, and you've got things like the Sustainable Development Goals. So the SDGs, which is, businesses talk about those, big businesses, global businesses, and investment houses are now talking about aiming at addressing the SDGs. And the Sustainable Development Goals is basically, in shorthand, a to-do list of the most pressing challenges we have in the world, both environmental and social. And there are 17 goals that are being aimed for by 2030. And we need billions of pounds of, you know, investment money aimed at these SDGs to alleviate these problems. Otherwise, and this is the big problem, is that there's a big cost to addressing all these issues, but the cost is far lower to us than the cost of not addressing them. So, for example, climate change, you know, some really clever people have worked out what the cost of that is to us, but actually the cost of not addressing it, all the economists have worked out, is 10 times more costly than the cost that we would bear to actually try and address these issues. And that's what people miss sometimes. I think, you know, the media sometimes like to criticize, you know, some of the things that are being done to try and address the problems we've got. And they will point to the cost of doing that and how it's going to cost the taxpayer, you know, X amount to actually address these issues. But what they're not saying is, if we don't do it, what will the cost be to us? Not just in monetary terms, but in terms of lifestyle. You know, if you've got a pension and you retire in a world where the planet is melting, it's not going to be worth anything to us. So we've got to think about that.
Absolutely. So we've got ESG funds. They started, as you say, becoming more and more of a existence and a commonplace. And then there was the development of impact funds. So talk to me about the difference between an ESG fund and an impact fund.
To me, ESG is what I would call an input. So it's basically, if you're running a business, you'd be looking at your environmental footprint. You'd be looking at, you know, how you treat your workers. You'd be looking at all those sorts of things that you do as a business, in terms of how you run your business. So it's operational. So it's their inputs. Whereas an impact investment would be looking at what is that company producing? So what's the product, what's the goods or services, the output that that company is producing? So ESG is an input, impact I would say is an output. So you'd say, as an example, Adidas, most people will have heard of Adidas. They are one of the most sustainable businesses, global businesses on the planet. So the stuff they do is, you know, in terms of their environmental footprint, their production and manufacturing, et cetera. But unfortunately, Shell suits and trainers are not going to save our world. Whereas...
You never know.
Yeah, maybe. So basically, that's the sort of company that you would invest in through an ESG fund.
Right.
Another example would be a company that produces, you know, something really helpful for the planet. So it could be something like producing wind solar panels or wind turbines or components that go towards something like a watch that helps to reduce or help people manage their diabetes, as an example, you know, some sort of watch that tracks, you know, your blood sugar levels, etc. So that would be more of an impact. Yeah, because it's focusing on the output rather than the inputs. And where it gets confusing is you could have a company, you know, in theory, let's go to the complete extremes. You could have a missile manufacturer who are really sustainable. So they're really good to their workers and they really, you know, they've got a low environmental footprint in terms of the way they manufacture missiles. But obviously, you know, would you really want them? And they could, in theory, sit if your fund is just about, we want the most highly rated ESG funds. In theory, that product, that company share could sit inside an ESG fund.
Wow.
Whereas obviously it wouldn't sit in an impact fund. But on the other hand, going to the other extreme, you could have a company that's got a terrible environmental footprint, that is manufacturing. So for, as an example, there was a lot of criticism around some sort of paper manufacturing companies or cardboard manufacturing companies where the process uses a lot of water. So there was an argument that that was environmentally, negligent or damaging. But the product itself, you know, recycled cardboard packaging, actually is going to have a positive impact on the planet. So it's about balancing up. And that's why analysis on this stuff is so crucial, because it's not straightforward, you know, and it's like anything in life, you know, you can look at stuff at superficial level, and that tends to be what happens in the media and particularly social media. People are operating at a very superficial level, but you know, it's really about looking below the surface and seeing what's really happening. And that's why clients need advisors like you, and advisors like you probably need someone like us to do some of that digging in the background. But there's a new labeling system that's coming in from the FCA, which is going to force product providers, so people who produce these funds, to actually sit in one of these labels if they want to use a sustainable title. So there's four labels. This only came out yesterday, actually, Tamsin. So this is literally hot off the press.
Right on the money.
yeah. I'll put a disclaimer out there that I haven't read the 200 pages in detail yet that the FCA put out at 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. It was the day before. But yeah, I've had 24 hours, but I still haven't got through it. So there are four labels. I know this much. Sustainable improvers. And that's why I talked about the overarching umbrella term being sustainable. So it's sustainable improvers, sustainable focus, and sustainable impact. And then the fourth label is mixed motives. So as you can imagine, that's like, you know, your three areas, and then your mixed motives is a mix of any of the three, basically. So would it be helpful just to tell you what the improvers, focus, and impact?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm guessing that the improvers is kind of almost a best of breed. You know, we might be Shell or we might be doing petrol and oil, but these are the things we're doing to try and make ourselves more sustainable and more kinder to the planet. Am I on the right track?
You should work for the FCA.
No, I shouldn't.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, you're exactly right. Well, this means that if you can guess what the labels mean, then that means they're working. So that you've got one out of four. Brilliant.
What was the next one?
Focus.
Environment. Was it impact focus?
Sustainable focus.
Okay. So that's got to be your impact type of things, hasn't it? The people who are making wind turbines and solar panels.
You've got improvers, focus, and then you've actually got impact as well.
Okay, so those are going to be impact, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
So let me help you out with focus. And I think this is this is the one that's slightly more tricky to understand. Focus is where you'd be investing in a business that has sustainable objectives, clearly, you know, got sustainable objectives, but isn't necessarily producing a product or service that where you could measure the impact of that. So, you know, it'd be less obvious. It wouldn't be as much of an impact. There wouldn't be as much intentionality around the impact as there would in the impact label. So, yeah, that's slightly, you know, it would be the sustainable businesses, I think, would fit into that. So something like an Adidas, maybe.
Right. Okay. Got you. That makes sense.
And you're right about the improvers. The improvers is where you've got a company who, because there's a big argument about should you disinvest from companies or should you be working with them to improve? Yes. Now, this is getting a little bit technical, because if you think about it, when you buy these funds, when they buy a stock, they buy a share in a company, it's on a secondary market. So you buy and sell on a secondary market. If you don't buy the share, someone else buys it. So it's not like by not buying it or by disinvesting, you're not really doing very much. And in some ways, I heard a great analogy about this the other day. It's a bit like we all take our rubbish out, don't we, on a particular day. I don't know what your day is. My day's Monday evening, right? I get home and my wife reminds me, this is my job, right? My wife reminds me I've got to put the rubbish out. Okay, so I kill the bags and I take them out and I put them in the various, we've got three bins, a blue bin, a green bin, and a black bin, and the food waste bin. So I get the bags and I put them in the bins. But disinvesting from a company that is harmful to the, you know, to people or planet, it's a bit like taking your rubbish out and putting it in your neighbor's bins.
Okay. Right, go on. You're going to have to give me more.
So basically what people are saying is what we should do, rather than chucking the rubbish out and, you know, giving it to you, letting someone else buy it, what we should do is own those companies, but engage with them to try and get them to do things better. So, right, you know, work with those companies to improve their, you know, the way they treat their employees, to work with those companies to make sure that they don't have slavery within their supply chains, to remove you know, modern slavery from their supply chains, to work with those companies to improve their environmental footprint. So that's what an improvers is basically. You'll have a mixed bag of companies in there, and they might be doing some really not very nice things at the moment. But the idea is that the asset manager engages with them, and because they own the shares or some of the shares, they have a vote at their shareholder meeting, and they could vote against, you know, things that they know are going to be detrimental to, you know, people or planet. So that's the idea of improvers, which is obviously very different to the other end of the spectrum, which is the impact end, which is where, you know, you've got companies producing things that are going to help hopefully achieve the SDGs at some point in the future.
Okay. Well, that makes some sense. And it's good that the FCA are starting to think about labelling these funds, because it might make it a little bit easier to figure out what's in what. One of the things that struck me over the last however long that I've kind of started looking into these funds is, particularly, and this may not be the case now, but I think it is, that there was always kind of a 10% gap in, particularly in ESG funds, where the fund manager could have 10% of the fund that wasn't necessarily under all the guidance that the rest of the assets needed to be under. 10% sounds like quite a lot to me. And I wondered A, is that still the case? And B, how does that sit with you? Because it didn't sit well with me if I was hoping to be investing in an ESG in a sustainable fund. I don't really want to think that 10% of it could be doing whatever the fund manager liked.
Yeah. I mean, I call this, I don't own the term. I got this from someone else. I learn a lot from other people, basically. I don't come up with anything original. It's all things I gather in.
We all do that.
Yeah. I call it the get out of jail free card. So, you know, it's like when you're playing Monopoly or whatever it is, and you've got that card in your pack, haven't you? And as soon as, you know, you get caught, you basically play the get out of jail free card. And that's like, oh, you didn't see the small print. We can hold 10% of that rubbish. You know, that's allowed in this, but you didn't read the small print. And that's because it was like, you know, this sort of minute in the back of the document somewhere. Look, I think that's annoying, and you know, you'd hope that people don't abuse that. But I can see why asset managers need to reserve some right for some flexibility. You know, in adverse market conditions, they may feel like they have, you know, they need some sort of mechanism by which they can, you know, minimize volatility, or, you know, minimize a downside risk in certain areas, and they would need to fly to some sort of mechanism, you know, financial instrument that just would not qualify but provides them with a volatility dampener of some sort. So I think you know, if I get off my box preaching at Hyde Park Corner and sort of look at it from a real world perspective, you know, at the end of the day, for all your clients and for most investors, ultimately they are savers, and this money is being saved for, you know, their retirement or for some purpose that they have, whether it's, you know, their children or grandchildren or school fees or whatever it might be. So we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, there's still a financial objective to this. That's why they're saving rather than giving the money away. So those asset managers don't listen to this, because it's just reinforcing that they should be doing this. But, you know, and I do think this is something we need to keep an eye on. Yeah. Cause you know, it's, I can understand why it's there, and I can see why it's in circumstances where you could justify using it. It is slightly galling if you find that they are kind of invested in certain things, which they shouldn't, you know, ideally wouldn't be. And it's, you know, and it's not at a time where there's extreme volatility or some financial reason for doing that. So again, you know, that's why people like us are crawling all over this stuff all the time, because we have to hold asset managers accountable. You know, it's the way the free market works. If you leave people to just do what they want, then there will be mission creep. You need the different areas, you need the different actors in the market to keep it working well together for everyone, to meet the objectives that everyone has. And it's that tension in the market where different players, you know, play different roles, which actually makes it work. And I think I'd love to see, Tamsin, a time where we can all collaborate and work together, rather than kind of being an us and them. And that's what we're trying to do now, is bring all the stakeholders together, you know, bring advisors, bring clients, bring asset managers, and say, look, we've all really got the same objective here. Let's be pragmatic, because, you know, there are, you know, we can't be purists. I always say, I think this was me, I don't think I nicked this from anyone else, but there's no such thing as a perfect investment. It just doesn't exist. If you look deeply enough into all of these things, even the really ethical funds and all the rest of it, there will be some little speck in there that, you know, that exists. And I sometimes sort of think about this from a, you know, I know this is a bit unethical, but diamonds, you know, they're very, very few pure diamonds. You know, they've all got some sort of inclusion in them or slightly odd color or whatever. And it's exactly the same as investments. There will be something somewhere, you know, and if you get your eyeglass out and you really look at it, there'll be something. But it's about managing that and managing those expectations of clients and saying, and that's what we do. We say, look, there's a whole load of exclusions here. They ideally wouldn't be invested in any of this, but unfortunately there are small specks here in these places because we've looked right through their supply chain. You know, we don't just look at what the company does. Who owns that company? You know, what other corporation owns that company and what are they doing? Or, you know, what about, they might be only producing cardboard boxes, but actually those cardboard boxes are being used to package up grenades that are sent, you know, always something. And it's about understanding, knowing what they are, and then making a decision yourself as to actually, I'm okay with that. I understand why that's there. Or saying, no, I don't agree with that. I don't want that at all. And then you're able to make a decision, isn't it? So it's providing the information so that people are empowered to make those decisions. And that's the reality, because there isn't anything pure out there.
Fair enough. Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a few minutes because I've got two questions to ask you that are probably, I don't know, the arguments for not doing this, I guess. So the first one is cost. So it tends to cost more to invest in a sustainable way. So if my aim is to increase my retirement pot, that's why I'm investing rather than putting the money in the bank or under the bed. If it's going to cost me more, then to get the same level of return, I've got to know the returns are going to have to be better because the costs are higher. Is that realistic? Or is there another argument for, even though the costs are higher, you should still do it?
Look, there are loads. That's a really good question, and it's very practical and it's very real, you know, because ultimately we look at what we're doing, and we look at whatever we're doing. When we buy something, we always want to get best value, don't we? We don't want to pay more for something than you should pay. But I think we've got to broaden out this conversation, right? Because I think this is urgent. Okay, this isn't, we're not messing about here. This is urgent. We've all seen that it's very hard to find people who are still denying climate change. There are a lot of people still doing it, but you've just got to experience the last few summers we've had, the way, you know, the weather events we're seeing around the world, et cetera. So I think I want to zoom out a little bit and say, you know, basically it's cheaper to save the planet than to destroy the planet. Yeah. and we will get to keep our lovely home, because we've got to think not just for ourselves, but what about the next generations? You know, what about the future generations? And this is real. You know, I'm not trying to make this stuff up. This is what government are talking about. COP28 is starting. I think it might be starting today, or it's on the horizon. This is what people are going to be discussing. Yeah, there is real urgency now. If we don't sort this out very, very soon, there will be no turning back, and we will see a very, you know, steep decline. So I get what people say when they say about price, and we look at that, but sometimes we need to zoom out a bit and look at the big picture, because we all have a responsibility. We all have a responsibility, and it might cost us something to take action and to do that. So by investing in these type of funds, generally speaking, the more impactful funds are going to be what's known as active managed funds. So I know you know that, Tamsin, but I don't know whether or not the people that listen to this podcast will understand the difference between active and passive
investing. Definitely worth explaining that.
Do you want to explain it, or shall I?
I'll leave that one with you.
Okay. Well, active management is basically where a fund manager is specifically going out and picking specific funds to include in their fund. Specific holdings, equities or bonds to put into their fund. That's an active managed fund. A passive managed fund, and you might have to correct me, Tamsin, if I get this slightly wrong, but basically it's where you take an exposure to the whole of market. So you try to get as many constituents from a particular market that you're investing in. So if you're investing in the UK, you'd basically try to get as big a spread of the UK companies available to invest in as you can, and hold that in your fund. So you're not really deciding whether you like that company A or that company B, and I'll buy that one rather than that one. You're actually saying I'll have a bit of everything, because you want to represent the market. So that's passive investing, and that can be done really cheaply. So a very low cost passive investing, whereas active management tends to have a higher cost, because you've got arguably more involvement by the asset manager, measuring, buying and selling, because these are impact funds. So you need to really understand, you know, really know those companies inside out. What are the companies? So there's a higher cost to that. And that is then passed on through the asset management charge, through the annual management charge of the fund to the investor. So I'd say, to give you a ballpark figure of the difference in cost, I reckon an equity fund, an actively managed equity fund, impact fund, will be around 80 basis points, so 0.8%. And, you know, what's a passive fund now? Less than 20.2?
Less than
0.2? So that's the difference. You're talking about, you know, possibly as much as 0.6, 0.65 difference per annum, which obviously compounding could be quite a lot of money, you know. And the other thing is not just the cost, it's the volatility, isn't it? So in theory, a passive fund doesn't move up and down as much, whereas an active fund could be more susceptible to tailwinds or headwinds. So they could shoot ahead, you know, quite quickly and grow quite quickly, but they can also fall quite quickly. So that's quite a difference. You know, it's the behavior of the fund that's slightly different. So it might be more volatile, and it also might be more expensive in terms of annual management costs. But like I say, it's really a values decision. It's like, okay, this might be costing me a little bit more, or it might cost me a lot more. I don't know. You'd need to look at the numbers. But actually, you know, what is the risk of not investing in this way? And I think one of the things that's going to change over the next 10 years, and this is something I heard Sir Alok Sharma say 2 days ago. I was at a conference he was speaking at. He's the representative of the government who's going to COP28. And the question was asked of him, if there was one thing that you would want to see change in the world, what would it be? And he said, please price climate risk into everything you do. So what that means is, what's not happening at the moment is there is no price for climate risk. So if a company is producing barrels of oil, and that's going to, we know that there's scientific proof to say that that is going to damage the planet, that risk is not being priced into the price of their stock. Okay. That is going to happen. And when that happens, you're going to have loads of assets that are held in these traditional funds, which are suddenly going to potentially no one's going to want to buy because the climate risk will have been priced in and it will remove value from those funds. And that's going to happen. I don't know if that will happen suddenly or whether that will happen over time, but you know, those are things that we have to factor in. So if you just look at price, you might be just looking at too small an area, and you might need to start to broaden out your thinking about whether it's just price that is actually going to impact on your overall, you know, the end story, basically. Sorry, that was a bit of a long-winded answer, wasn't it?
No, it's all right. It's all good. You won't believe this, but we've actually come to the end of our time together. Is there anything that you want to say to wrap up? Anything you want to add to what you've said already?
I think the only thing I would say is that, firstly, if you've got to this point in the podcast and you've stayed with us, thank you. Thank you for listening. That is something I would like to say.
Absolutely.
I hope that what I've said does make some sense, you know, to people. And, you know, I am very passionate about this subject. And I do think that, you know, by investing in this way, we're doing what's right, not only for us, but for, you know, the rest of the community around us and potentially future communities that come along. And I also would just like to say that, you know, the cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of, you know, climate change that will result. And there is a stat that says that 300% of GDP by the end of the century will be destroyed by climate change. So, you know, there is a cost to not doing anything. And I think we need to think deeply about that. But do, you know, if you're listening to this, do speak to Tamsin, do speak to your financial planner about these things and just have the debate, you know, even if you don't want to do anything now, just keep an open mind and keep thinking and talking about it. And I hope, you know, that's something that's of interest.
Absolutely. Thank you. And we'll pop the video that you mentioned earlier in the show notes. So if anybody wants to watch that, they can do. That was absolutely brilliant. I massively appreciated your time today, Gavin. Thank you so much. That was there. It's very clear how incredibly passionate you are about this subject, and hopefully that's opened a few eyes of our listeners today as well. So many thanks for joining me. Hi, and I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Smart Divorce podcast. If you would like to get in touch, please have a look in the show notes for our details or go onto the website www.smartdivorce.co.uk. Also, if you are listening on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify and you wouldn't mind leaving us a lovely 5-star review, that would be fantastic. I know that lots of our listeners are finding this is incredibly helpful in their journey through separation, divorce, and dissolving a civil partnership. Also, if you would like some further support, we do have a Facebook group now. It's called Separation, Divorce, and Dissolution UK. Please do go on to Facebook, search up the group, and we'd be delighted to have you join us. The one thing I would say is do please answer their membership questions. Okay, have a great day and take care.